Hello, good morning. Did you hear the passage? It's the Luke presents this as the introduction to Jesus' ministry. And it's presented as a summary both of the content of Jesus' ministry and also of people's response. So in about half a chapter, he's paraphrasing the rest of the gospel. This is what Jesus is on about, and this is what people will do. They'll try and kill him. And in fact, at the end, they're successful. So immediately preceding it are the desert temptations, and immediately following it, you've got teaching and healing and casting out demons in Capernaum. And it's set in Nazareth, which is interesting because that's not the power seat. If you were going to introduce the ministry of someone you thought was important, you'd probably put it in Jerusalem, but Luke has chosen to set it in Nazareth. Luke, the two verses before the Nazareth scene say he's going through the region preaching and teaching and healing. So although this is often talked about as the first incident of Jesus' public ministry, even in Luke it's not actually the first incident. It's the first one Luke talks about. So Luke has chosen to say this as the introduction, although that's not actually the first one. In Matthew and in Mark, the same story is repeated, but it's shorter. They don't try and kill him. Just small detail. Matthew and Mark introduce Jesus' ministry by saying that he's going around saying, "Repent, the kingdom of God is at hand." And they have this story much further into their narrative, so he's been doing quite a lot before it gets to this point. They have the reason the crowd rejects him because they cannot accept that the local carpenter's son could be the Messiah. So there's a disbelief of the possibility of a local. They don't try to kill him, but Jesus can't do very much with them because of their lack of faith in the other two accounts. But Luke gives other reasons. So the big question, not the only question, but a big question for me is, why did the nice people of Nazareth want to kill Jesus? Now, if you're somebody who doesn't like listening to a sermon or you're busy with the children and only listening to little bits, perhaps you can just sit with, if Jesus came here, what could make you reject him? That's a question to sit with. You're welcome to listen to me as well, but if you can't listen, that's fine. So Luke gives other reasons to Matthew and Mark. In Luke, the crowd seems very keen on Jesus' message, and they recognise him as the local boy done good. And then Jesus turns on them. They're very impressed, and he says really rude things to them. Now, some people commentating suggest this is because they failed to recognise him as the Son of God. They talk about him as the son of Joseph. I think it's a big ask for the community, to be honest, to have thought of him as the Son of God. Or others say that he turned on them because he could see that in their hearts they didn't actually accept the message, that they were just being congratulatory on the outside. So this is what Jesus says to them. He says, well, they've said lovely things to him. Oh, they're very impressed. And he says, well, you're going to say to me, physician, heal yourself, which is a common parable of the time, a secular parable. He says, you're going to demand that I do here in Nazareth the things I'm doing in Capernaum. Now, Luke actually hasn't said he's gone to Capernaum yet, although he goes there next. Capernaum's about 20 kilometres away. So that's about the distance to have your best rival town, really. The people who are close enough to know them and close enough to hate them. Like the Dockers and the Eagles, precisely. For me, I grew up in Morley. And we all knew that we were just a little bit better than the people in Lockridge, because that was the next suburb. Many years later, when friends of mine were considering going to set up Peachtree Community in Lockridge and invited me to go with, I couldn't do it. It was Lockridge. I could live in any other poor suburb in Perth, but I couldn't live there. That's my Capernaum. Oh, bother, this is being recorded. Would you take that minute? Very odd. He says to them, I'm a prophet, and you are going to reject me like the old prophets were rejected. You're going to reject me in my own country. And then he gives two examples from Hebrew scriptures of where God worked outside of Israel. The first is Naaman the Syrian, who's an army commander, who comes to the prophet Elisha and is healed of his leprosy by bathing in the river. And the second is the widow of Zarephath in Sidonia, who is saved from starvation by the prophet Elijah. And then in case they've missed the point, he emphasises that those are both non-Jewish examples where God was helping people outside the Jewish community. And then they try to kill him. And on the Sabbath too. And perhaps I would too, or at least be pretty pissed off, because he's really rude. He's in his home church, his home community, and he says things that are very offensive. What he's saying is, I do not belong to you. This is in the cultural context of patronage, where if you had wealth or power, you had a social obligation to your people, to favour your people by exercising your power for them. So Nazareth could legitimately expect that their homegrown hero would come and do the best work with them, and if there was anything left over, would spread further. They'd heard about his work through Galilee, and now he'd come home, and they're expecting the good times have started. So I want to imagine for us, imagine one of our young people discovered a free, easy, cheap cure for cancer, a painless cure for cancer. We would support them. We would probably give them money for their study. We would think wonderful things of them. We'd invite them to come and speak. Think of our actual young people. David Joy is considering medicine. He might discover a cure for cancer. You know, Claire Quicks, she might find something under the ocean in the marine studies. You know, Elkin's psychology, she might discover there's something you can actually do with your mind. And we would invite them. Let's go with David Joy. We would invite them to come and speak, and we would be proud of them, and we would affirm them, and we would ensure that our population of cancer patients turned up, which is quite a lot of us here. I won't name names, but when I was thinking, I could think of about six people here at least who've had cancer within the time that I've known here, and I've been here 10 years. So imagine that that's what's happened. They're here, they're spent, they're known for this, here they are. And then instead of saying, well, thank you very much for your support, and it's been lovely, they said, actually, you can't have any free cancer meds. If you want to have my cancer cure, you need to join the public hospital waiting list. And I actually prioritise people with a healthcare card, so most of Mount Hawthorne will miss out. We might be a bit miffed. Don't they owe us something? Don't they belong to us? It's possible that when they grasped that he was extending this vision of the Messiah beyond the in crowd, they genuinely believed he was a false prophet, that it could not be possible to be the Messiah for beyond Israel. And that's a very serious offence. Deuteronomy says it's an offence deserving of death to be a false prophet, and that Israel will be judged on whether it can identify false prophets. So maybe they thought they were doing the right thing to rid their community of this falseness. Or maybe they weren't that high-minded and they got carried along with the angry mob. And Nazareth might have seen this coming when the quote from Isaiah that Jesus reads, he stops before the bit about vengeance. Because the next line is, I've come to do this, 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 and to declare the day of vengeance for our Lord. That's the favourite bit, isn't it? The bit where God totally trounces your enemies, where we are liberated by the people we hate being oppressed. And are we hoping for anything else now? See, Let's take a moment and think about who the outsiders are for us. If you're only listening to small bits, just listen for here. Who is completely other for you? Outside, not like us. Perhaps Islamic State. Perhaps pedophiles. Perhaps politicians who oversee migration policy. Perhaps the CEOs of certain multinational corporations. Those who are operating broken systems that damage people. Or perhaps there's a Christian group from your past where you've experienced hurt. I want us to sit for a moment in Nazareth and hear Jesus come and proclaim liberation for these outsiders and omit to mention vengeance. So that's why they tried to kill him. And maybe also because he mentioned Capernaum and they're the rival football team. But why was Jesus so rude to them? Why did he stir them up to this? It was all going well. They were being very complimentary. Was it so important to prove this point? Or is it that Luke, as the author, has expanded the original story for a message that his community needs to hear? Is his community somehow needing to hear this point put in such an abrupt way? I think the key is that it's following after the desert temptations, and this is the context. In the Godly Play stories, we talk about Jesus goes into the desert to find out who he is and what his work would be. It's the phrase we repeat. And there's three temptations. Does anyone know what they are? Three. Stones and bread. Throw him off the temple. Yep. And the angels will get him. And worship Satan. You can have all the kingdoms if you worship Satan. And he's got a good comeback for each of those in the desert. He's going well. And then it says, the devil left him until the opportune moment, which in Eugene Peterson's paraphrase is, the devil retreated temporarily, lying in wait for another opportunity. Now, I think Luke is presenting Nazareth as that opportunity. It's the next temptation. So what is it? What is the temptation? It could be bound by the petty loyalties and divisions of your people. It could be a hero for these people, not the prophet of God pointing people to God, but the focus of the adulation yourself. It could be heal on demand, which is a lot like turn stones into bread, really. It could be have all the world worship you, by letting go of the thing you've actually come for and being what they want, which is a lot like worshipping Satan, actually. It could be don't make a scene, don't rock the boat, be nice, don't embarrass your mama. It's not exactly clear what the main issue is, but Jesus seems to feel that something was threatening to derail him. Now, perhaps he just had a gut sense, so he quite fiercely restates the track that he believes he needs to be on. Good news for outsiders, led by the Spirit, not by the pressure of the crowd. And of course, the reaction of the crowd confirms his suspicions that something's amiss. It doesn't necessarily mean he could read their hearts, but he had a hunch that he was being tempted. And he was right. They wanted him for their hero. They weren't necessarily interested in what he was actually on about. And perhaps Luke, in writing, felt that his community, the Lucan community, had got tempted away from the core message and needed, so when he's telling the story of Jesus, he wants it up front and really abruptly framed. This is what we're on about. So what was Jesus actually on about? The desert temptations are all about what Jesus is not. And this is saying what Jesus is for. And that's really important because we're often, it's not that hard to identify what we're against, but it can be much harder to identify what we're for. I had a really wise person say this to me lots of years ago when the church I was in was very strongly against abortion. He said, that's your moral decision how you decide that, but if you are going to be against, then you need to be actively and vocally for single mothers, for disabled children, for, and he had a whole list, for the homeless, for all the reasons that people choose to seek an abortion. If you're going to say no to this, you must say yes to this. So here is Jesus saying yes. He's been in the desert and he said no, and now it's his time to say yes. And he defines his ministry using the words of Isaiah. I'm anointed by the Spirit of God, he says, sorry. He is anointed by the Spirit of God. I'm good news for the poor. The word tokos is beggars. It's got a connotation of to crawl or cringe, the afflicted. I'm liberty for the captives, release for the prisoners, sight for the blind. That word's actually not there. The word in the Hebrew that he's quoting from is for those bound and opening, and it's been interpreted that he means blindness. To let the oppressed go free, to send the downtrodden away relieved, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. How do you hear this text? It's a familiar one. We've heard it lots of times. If you grew up like me in a liturgical church with the lectionary, you would have heard it about January most years. Is this one of the best to really stick it to those Christians who disagree with you, who think heaven's all about where you're going when you die, that it's, that's the point, that this is one of your real proof texts? Yeah, I want to stick it to them. Take a moment to sit with that response, because that's some of my response, if I'm honest with myself, particularly in the light of what Jesus is saying about outsiders and his reaction to the crowd wanting to claim him for themselves. Or perhaps it's one that you're sick of having thumped at you by Christians who like to think they've got Jesus cornered with this social justice thing. Perhaps this text is a great consolation for you in times of oppression, hardship, boundness, brokenness. Isaiah's text actually includes the phrase to soothe the brokenhearted, but only some of the manuscripts pull that forward. It's in the Greek and not the Hebrew. So, or the other way around. No, it's in the Greek and not the Hebrew. If this is a text of consolation for you, then let nothing I say today dissuade you from feeling consoled. Experience that as the truth of this text today. Perhaps all this stuff about release and liberty and freeing the poor makes you feel guilty. Perhaps it fills you with hope as a wonderful series of promises. Or perhaps it fills you with despair as a 2,000-year-old proclamation that doesn't appear to have been fulfilled. Is this a text for you or for someone else? Are you poor, oppressed, blinded, enslaved? Yes and also no. I think we as white, Western, powerful, educated, wealthy people need to be humble enough to admit that Jesus didn't come first for us. We're not the centre of Jesus' mission. We're included, but we didn't come first. But because he came for all the oppressed, Whether that's those crushed by poverty or literally enslaved, or whether that's the boundness of my habitual grouchiness and my inability to forgive, which oppresses those around me as well as myself, we can know that he came for us too. But I firmly believe this was not intended as a metaphor. Jesus spoke to people who were predominantly not rich or powerful, and he says he's come to change their situation, not just give them eternal hope. For all of those who are hurting, he's come to bring healing and release. But it didn't happen while he was alive. So how do we respond to that? There's three possible interpretations of why that hasn't happened. The first is that he failed. And maybe he's going to come back and try again later. We have to hold that this is a legitimate reading of the story of Jesus, is that his followers, so disheartened with it failing, invented a story to carry their hope on. It's not what I believe, but it is a possibility that must be held as part of our leap into faith. Another possibility is that he succeeded, but it wasn't a literal success. That he succeeded with the people he was with to let them know that they were not bound in the eyes of God, that they may be slaves to an earthly master, but their person did not belong to anyone but God. So to give them a sense of freedom, a sense of dignity and person within what otherwise remained unchanged. Or it may be that he began a process of change which is ongoing by instituting the way of love and compassion, which is where I sit in terms of how do I cope with these promises not being fulfilled, that they are being fulfilled but have not been fulfilled. Jesus is not anti-wealth in this passage or anti-rich people, but he's pro-poor people. He declares the year of the Lord's favour, which is the Jubilee year. The Jubilee years from Jewish law tradition. It's written in Leviticus 25. If you want an interesting bedtime read, Leviticus 25 is great. No, really. It's an astounding piece of property legislation where both the land and the people belong to God and they cannot be bought or sold. They can only be leased and not for more than 49 years. Families were custodians of their peace forever. It's a remarkable piece of legislation to found a community's understanding of their land and people. Did Israel ever do it? It's not clear historically if they ever did the Jubilee. They did the Sabbath year. Every seventh year was a Sabbath, and then every 49 or 50, depending on how you interpret the text, was to be like a super Sabbath. So the Jubilee was a super Sabbath for a whole year, where the slaves were released, the land was returned. The land was not ploughed, so they had to have enough food to get them through. It would be 2 years then if it was the 50th year, because it was both the Sabbath year and the following year. So it was structured as an exercise of deep trust. You had to rely on each other, you had to rely on God to get through this period, to be back to your 6 years of working the land. Some scholars think they were practicing it, possibly even up to only 200 years before Jesus. And those same scholars calculate that Jesus' ministry fell in a Jubilee year. And so it's possible that he stands in Nazareth in what should have been a Jubilee year and wasn't being practiced, and says it's the year of the Lord. Other calculations, it really depends on whether you decide that the Jubilee year is the seventh of the seven Sabbaths or whether it's an extra one in addition to it. And actually most scholars think it's the 49th year rather than 2 years of... They just don't think culturally that you could survive in that kind of a climate without planting for two whole years. So if you count it as 50 years, I think it is, We're in a Jubilee year now. As of last September until next September, this is the year of the Jubilee according to that Jewish calendar. So that's the historic way. The other way it's used in Jewish culture at Jesus' time is that the prophet Isaiah uses the image of the Jubilee as an image of the fulfillment of the return from exile. So when much of our Bible is written or edited while they're in exile in Babylon, and this strong image of when God restores us to our land and our people, it will be the Jubilee, the sense of God restoring us to our land, not just us giving it back to each other. And so metaphorically, it's got that sense of the end of exile and the return to fullness. And Jesus comes to Nazareth and said, "This is happening now." And he's probably picking up the Isaiah reference more than the literal, historical, legal reference. This return of God to fullness and everyone being where they should be and things being right is happening now. And first century Jews loved this piece of Isaiah. It's got liberation and jubilee, and they loved it and they sang it and they prayed it, a lot like we sing Handel's Messiah. But we don't actually expect anyone to walk in and say it's really happening now in our actual lives. And the repeat notion in all those statements from Isaiah is aphesis, a Greek word that I love, which means release, forgiveness, liberation. It has overtones of community, it has moral overtones, it has legal overtones. So it's a very broad and deep word of release, of letting go. Let it, in the Beatles, let it be is aphesis, 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 aphesis if it's a verb. Aphesis, aphesis, let it be, let it be. Let it go. Luke begins and frames Jesus' work by saying aphesis is central. Because all the things, release from slavery, freedom from debt, bondage, out of bondage, all the pieces that are in that, they don't all use the word aphesis, but they all have the concept of release, freedom, letting go. So Matthew and Mark introduce Jesus' ministry as the kingdom of God. Luke introduces the ministry of as aphesis. Not just in passing, but the time of aphesis is here. So for us, and if you're only listening to small bits, this is my things to think of to take home. How are we manifesting aphesis in our daily lives? This week, who will you afeet? Release, forgive, lift the burden, free from bondage, liberate. Perhaps it will be yourself. Perhaps it will be someone you love. But may it also extend to someone you don't love. Perhaps someone you resent or feel in competition with. Where is your Capernaum? Or perhaps someone that I am indifferent to. Maybe the workers who made the clothes I'm considering buying, or the labourers who picked the tomatoes in the tin I'm thinking of grabbing off the shelf, or the children who live with the toxic waste material made as a byproduct of the electronic device I'm picking up. Those who are outside because they're beyond my view, who are impacted by my life, but outside my line of sight. How can I be aphesis for them? Well, the take-home for you may be, how are there areas where I claim Jesus as my own possession, my trump card, in my political agenda or my religious soapbox or my social commentary? Perhaps an area for prayer and growth this week is to let him belong to those with an alternate view. Could it be that I need to set Jesus free, or to be set free from possessing him? Am I tempted to go with the crowd, perhaps especially if they like me and say nice things, or seem terribly reasonable in their requests? Is there a small way this week that I can reorient myself to Jesus' liberation and unbounded welcome where I might be following community opinion. Are you brokenhearted? Can you read these words this week as your prayer, over and over, and hear the desire of God for you? Aphesis. We are both called to hear good news and to be good news. So let's go into this week and be good news. Participate in the mission of Jesus to be good news to the poor, balm for the brokenhearted, freedom for captives, sight for the blind, relief for the oppressed. Let our good news burst beyond our boundaries and prejudices. And also hear the good news of Jesus coming among us to say, now is the time when ancient hopes are being fulfilled. Now is the time of Ephesus. Liberation is coming now. I'm happy to take comments or questions if that's important. Is there a thing of me? Just for the tape, if you can use the mic, then the recording can hear you.
Hello. I just thought it was important to ask you a question because I remember saying last time that no one had asked you a question. So I was thinking of a question the whole sermon. I think you're really on the money when in trying to explain why they wanted to kill him. I come from a poor working class city, and one of the prevailing memes that you live by is that everybody's crap, that we are all mediocre, and that this is what it means to work and to live and to strive. So for anybody to try and stand up on top of the crowd is to invite rejection. So that's one layer. The second thing is he spoke to the real things that people struggled with, the physicality of being poor, oppressed, downtrodden, used. So things like blindness, poverty, all of that kind of, are the very things that people hope for and yet have no hope. So you can't stand out. You're already a false prophet to try and be better than us because you're saying something about us. You're talking about the things that we want and then to say, oh, and by the way, there are people far more deserving than you outside of this community, is to raise people's expectations and then dash them. I would have got really angry if someone started saying that in my community, as part of where I grew up. So, yeah, that totally makes sense.
Thanks. And things like blindness are poverty in a culture where if you can't see, you can't work. If you can't work, you've got no income.
Thanks, Claire. That was very profound. Can you hear me? Is it on? Justin, thanks. That was very profound. And it brings to my mind a couple of things that were said at the other end of Jesus' ministry. When Jesus said to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. And also the disciples, the day after he died, said, and we thought he was the one who was going to liberate Israel from the Romans. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we really came across strongly when we were in Israel. There is still that sense that one day Jesus will return and Israel will become top dog nation in the world. For me, Jesus has said, no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not bringing a political solution to this problem of oppression. I'm bringing a spiritual and personal solution. Brings to mind something Ken once said about the kingdom of God is not a place to live, it's a way to live. So that sort of helps pull that together. And for me, I feel very frustrated that it is still being interpreted as a political solution when Jesus is saying it's not a political solution, it's something bigger and more profound and more wonderful, and it applies to everybody.
one of the issues that come to me, Claire, is when you said it's best to stick it up Christians who confront you over certain issues. Now, I've, on the email system, I've got a lot of Christian friends that confront me with some of these issues, and I thank you for the clarity of your delivery today, because I can now respond effectively, I think.